I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Welcome to Skylines, the City Metric podcast. I'm John, and this week we are going to talk about the end of the world. Let's put it that way. For this cheery episode, I'm joined by my colleague, India Bork. You're a sort of our environment correspondent, aren't you?
Yes, hello.
Which you chose that as your specialism. You decided that the thing you would like to be spending your life writing about is the imminent death of humanity and possibly all life on it. I mean, are you particularly depressed that day?
Or? No, it does feel appropriate this week, though, with us both being pretty sick in the office for different reasons.
Yeah, everyone in the office right now is particularly. But, you know, we're going to work through that, despite, you know, that's our commitment to podcasting is such that we're not going to let some cold stand in the way of
containing our germs in the podcast room.
Yeah. So the reason we decided to do a climate change special is because there have been, let's phrase this as a question. It feels to me like there have been an unusually high number of extreme weather events recently. Is that definitely true, or is this just like, are we just more aware of things than we would have been in the past?
So, yes, there is evidence to suggest that extreme weather events are getting more frequent. So obviously we've always had big storms, hurricanes, floods, back to biblical times, very well documented. But the frequency and the extent of their impact is much greater now due to human-caused climate change. It's just completely changing the way these things are operating.
So there was that moment a couple of weeks ago where I think there were three hurricanes in the Caribbean at the same time, which is that's pretty rare, isn't it?
It was very rare. I mean, each event, you've probably been watching it on the news too, I was glued to the screen where as Hurricane Irma approached, came across the Caribbean and approached the coast of Florida, and it seemed that it was almost 24-hour round-the-clock coverage of it, which did become very, very addictive. But yes, each one of those hurricanes has broken records. So first of all, there was Harvey, who hit Houston and Texas, and that was it.
I like the way we're going with who there. It's like we're really sort of leaning into the, giving them individual identities. But yeah, sorry, I shouldn't interrupt.
There is actually a proposal to start naming these hurricanes after climate change deniers, so the Koch brothers hurricane, which is quite a nice idea. But they're already spreading devastation on. So Harvey hit, and it was the wettest tropical storm on US record by the time it hit Houston. Dumped a hell of a lot of water on the city. Then you had Irma, which was the longest lasting Category 5 hurricane on record. And then Maria, who just hit, I do say who, don't I? That's very which, probably better, which hit Puerto Rico. It was a Category 4 hurricane, but it was the fastest, one of the fastest storms to intensify from a Category 1 to a Category 5 over the past few days. So each of these storms is just breaking records. So you get someone like Trump saying, oh, they're not so big, or we've always had big storms. Yes, you have always had big storms, but just the magnitude of the whole picture is quite something.
It's interesting what you say about watching it on television, because, you know, we did that at home. It's quite weird when you think of, like, you know, catastrophic weather events becoming a form of entertainment. But there's definitely an element of that, isn't there? I mean, there is something weirdly addictive about it. Yeah.
So interesting. I was completely hooked. I found myself with a kind of ethical, theoretical problem, which was, obviously, you want the hurricane to cause least devastation as possible for the sake of the people involved, but on the other hand, you really wanted Trump to get the picture that something needs to be done about climate change.
Yeah, I mean, I think if there is a way of kind of short-circuiting that ethical dilemma, I think it's maybe that I can't quite imagine how bad things would have to be to persuade Donald Trump he'd been wrong about something. I just don't think a disaster of that level exists. I think it's...
Sadly, I think you're completely right.
Interesting, like, watching these reporters standing in reasonably peaceful streets, the eye of the storm, and, like, the wind gradually getting up as they... As the kind of the hurricane moves over them again. Have you ever been in a hurricane?
I haven't, have you?
Nearly.
No way. Wait, yeah. When?
2012 it would have been, which I only remember because I remember sending a grumpy tweet saying that I appear to be in the direct path of a hurricane, but on the upside so was Mitt Romney, because the Republican convention up in Tampa, just up the Florida coast, was on target as well. No, it missed in the end, but we were kind of stuck inside for 2 days while it was just a reasonably nasty rainstorm.
What did you do?
I think we watched a box set of Aaron Sorkin's The Newsroom. It was kind of like the sort of Disneyland version of the hurricane. You could kind of go out and sort of get blown around a bit, but reasonably occasionally, like, you know, one of the pool chairs would fly past or something. But, you know, you were never in any actual danger. So you kind of feel like you got the hurricane experience without ever actually taking any risks.
That's so interesting you say it's like the Disneyland experience, because I've heard on the radio recently a few people say it's like being in a film. And actually, I interviewed someone who was in a experienced a very bad wildfire in Portugal earlier this year, and again they compared it, just in telling me their story, like you said, it was like being in a film. That made me think, it's so interesting, we're so used to the disaster films, which are very simplistic narratives where it's really concentrated on the immediate event. So, you know, it does seem to be quite similar to the experience, but it also allows the experiences to be very neatly tied up in a kind of filmic beginning, middle, end. And we like that as humans. We like being able to tie things up in neat boxes, Janice.
I guess also this kind of... There's a sort of distancing effect in the kind of cinematic way of seeing these things, where you kind of imagine them as... I mean, you said beginning, middle and end, but you do kind of think about the immediate event rather than long-term causes or long-term impacts.
Exactly, yeah.
And it's exactly. Not just a matter of, like, surviving these things or like, imagining, well, we've done that, that's done now. Because if an area is particularly prone to hurricanes or storm surges or whatever it may be, that's probably, this is not going to be a one-off, right? Like, there's going to be another one somewhere down the road. So why has climate change made extreme weather events like this more common?
So analysis from Carbon Brief suggests that 63% of all extreme weather events studied to date have been made more likely by human-caused climate change. For hurricanes, that's because warmer seas evaporate more quickly and warmer air holds more vapour. So for every half degree Celsius in warming, the atmosphere can hold about 3% more moisture. So that's how hurricanes work.
Yeah, we're kind of focusing a bit on hurricanes here. Because, well, again, probably because of the pictures, really. But that's not the only form of extreme weather events that we're seeing.
Not at all. Right. So you've got the wildfires. Los Angeles has seen its largest bushfire in history. 1 million acres have been burned in Montana. According to one study, the total area burned in the western US over the past 33 years was double the size it would have been without climate change. You even had wildfires in Greenland.
Greenland surprises me that it's Greenland, because it's like imagining an ice storm in like Lagos or something. It just doesn't fit with your mental picture of it, does it?
Not at all. And it's particularly worrying in places where there's a lot of methane in the permafrost to be released, just to make you even more worried.
So something that we've almost talked about a number of times on this podcast, but we never actually got there, because every time I tried, Stephanie would start making squeaking noises and demand we talk about something else, is the fact that the Arctic didn't really freeze last winter, did it? Where's that fit into the picture?
Arctic melt saw the summer ice cap fall to well below average, I think, but it was about the eighth lowest on average. And as we've seen in the press this week, if things aren't always the most or the biggest, then people start to assume climate change isn't that bad, but the trends are very clear. There's always going to be fluctuation within a trend bracket, but you know that bracket sadly is not going.
So the point is that, you know, if you get the second worst event ever, then we don't hear about it so much, when in fact it's still pretty bloody awful at that point, right? So why did you find it so addictive to watch exactly?
There's definitely the rolling news element of it. It was something that was approaching, you knew was going to happen, you wanted to find out what was going to happen next. And there was something addictive, I think, about the immediate experience of it. So people who were there have talked about experiencing it like a film. Simultaneously, people around the world are literally watching it unfold on the TV screens. But there's also, when you turn something into a spectacle, it becomes easier to grasp. If you think of the classic disaster movies, they follow a very predictable arc, beginning, middle, end, you know, the rising tension, the drama, then the conclusion is always kind of a wrapping up. It's always saving the day. And that's something I think Donald Trump really understands. And that's why he was keen to, like, big them up beforehand and say, oh, they're the, you know, what did he say? He said something like, I think of Harvey, who said, even experts have said this is never, they've never seen one like this. Really bigging up the drama so that he could...
Like he was talking about his Electoral College majority again, basically. It was the same register, wasn't it?
Exactly. So he could swoop in and be everyone's saviour. And that just doesn't work when you're trying to tell us, when you're telling the story of climate change.
I found it quite interesting to, I mean, just on a certain basic human level, it's just quite funny watching reporters get blown around.
Just like
clinging to trees or something. You can tell they just desperately want to ask the producer if they can go inside now.
It's true. I hope someone had coffee on hand for them. One of the most things that I think will stay with me from the coverage of it was the reports of people in Florida shooting at the storms. Did you read that?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't sure if this was a parody or a joke or what, because I mean, you just think, like, if there's like a 180 mile an hour wind coming towards you, probably what you don't want to do is give it bullets.
It's true. Apparently, they were showing warnings that they could come back and hit people, but
I would think.
But the thing that really struck me about it, so at first you're kind of like, oh no, it's just Americans being complete gun happy again. But then you also think, well, actually, it's a sign of desperation. A lot of gun owners live in quite deprived areas in America. And if you're shooting into a storm as a way to stop it, it just means you're out of control. It's like a helpless thing, really. And that is the real problem of these storms, is that they do disproportionately impact people on low income. So the result of Hurricane Irma has hit hardest elderly people in care homes where the power ran out, people on low incomes who get pushed close to the edge of being able to cope because maybe their means of business has been hit, or even they can't go to work because everything's shut and they don't get their paycheck. And then obviously around the world, developing countries are also going to be hit really hard. So it is a tale of two storms.
So sometimes when we talk about this stuff, I get the sense that we talk too much about how it's affecting the developed world and not enough about how it's affecting the developing world, or I think it's probably having rather more of an impact. So you've been speaking to someone about that.
Yes, I spoke to someone called Dr. Salim al-Haq, who is the director of the International Centre for Climate Change and Development at the Independent University of Bangladesh. And so he does a lot of work with the international community in building negotiating capacity and supporting developing countries in adapting to climate change.
So he's really on the front line of this one in two ways, at least.
Exactly, yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
As the director at the International Centre for Climate Change and Development at the Independent University of Bangladesh.
That's correct.
And you've worked at the International Panel on Climate Change as a lead author, and you're working in Bangladesh right now.
Correct, yes. I used to be based in London. I was with an institute there called the International Institute for Environment and Development, IIED, in London. So I used to run the climate change program there for many years. I've become what they call a senior fellow. So I'm now based in Bangladesh.
Were you there during August when one of the heaviest monsoons in 30 years hit the city and swept across from Southeast Asia?
That's correct.
What is the experience of that like on the ground?
Well, it's been extremely traumatic and difficult for the people that have been hit. It's not been something that is unexpected, because the rains and the flood started in Nepal, upstream in the River Ganges, and then it traveled through India, through Bihar, and then arrived in Bangladesh. So we knew it was coming for a number of days. So the number of deaths in Bangladesh are relatively few, because people were able to get out of harm's way themselves. But the devastation in terms of crop damage in particular, and also other kinds of infrastructure, has been quite severe. People have lost their houses, their homes, their crops. They're now living in embankments and making do on higher ground.
And the monsoons obviously happen every year, but is this damage
more extensive?
This
is a particularly bad one, yes, exactly. I mean, we're used to monsoons. This is not unexpected, but this one was a particularly bad one. And hence, the previous precautions that had been taken were not sufficient. They breached the embankments and flooded areas that would not normally have been flooded.
How much of that is due to climate change? Has anyone been able
attributing a single event to climate change is a very risky thing. I don't think many climate scientists who study the frequency of events and the global modelers would be very comfortable attributing this particular event because of climate change. But I think where the attribution is more robust is that this kind of magnitude of event, which is a 1 in 50 year event, has happened already several times in the last 20 years, let alone 50 years. And that is the kind of thing that climate change models do predict will happen. These abnormal events are not likely to remain abnormal anymore. They may become the new normal.
And is this new normal, as you put it, is this something that is possible to prepare for in the future in places like Bangladesh?
Yes. Well, yes and no. I mean, there are limits to how much we can prepare and adapt. I would say Bangladesh is relatively well adapted to flood. So what the farmers living in the villages will do is they build their houses on raised hillocks. They will grow a crop of rice, which ripens and can be harvested before the floods begin, unless they come very early, which happens again sometimes. As the water starts to rise, they'll harvest the rice, the land will get inundated, and it becomes like a vast sheet of water with habitation islands in between. They'll then take out their boat and they'll go fishing. So that's sort of the adaptation, the harmonious adaptation of living and livelihoods of the people in Bangladesh for centuries. Now, what has happened in the meantime is two things. One is, we have intervened in many of the areas to try and prevent the floods from coming in by building embankments. And these embankments but are now being breached more frequently, and that's what's happened this time. So the question now is, should we build higher embankments to protect us from the bigger floods, or just give up altogether and let the land get flooded. And this is something that is a bit of a debate. My position is that in the rural areas, it has actually been a mistake to try and prevent flooding from taking place. It's better to let the river flood, and that what that does is allows the floodplain to be replenished. But when it comes to protecting infrastructure, where we've built cities and towns, that is not a viable proposition. There we do have to protect them. We build dikes around them to protect the infrastructure. So it's a sort of horses for courses approach. This, by the way, is not a unique to Bangladesh situation. It's the same problem that the River Rhine in Europe has and the River Mississippi in the U.S. has. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers have embanked the entire Mississippi, and that sometimes causes even greater floods, because when you offer protection and then that protection breaches, then the damage can be much bigger than if you didn't offer protection in the first place.
One of the problems people have raised about the situation in America is that there's been a lot of building on floodplains, a lot of development. Is that problem shared in Dhaka?
Absolutely. That's the same problem in Dhaka. We've built in places where we shouldn't have been building, and that's made the problem more acute. We've filled up what used to be wetlands within the Dhaka, greater Dhaka area. And so when we do have very heavy rains, there's nowhere for the water to go, and it floods the roads, and the roads become rivers. These are man-made problems. And again, this is not just Bangladesh. This is a similar problem around the world.
And are there plans in Bangladesh to try and change that?
There's a lot of discussion. It's not easy to change to it, but you can stop doing bad things. In fact, we do have legislation that prevents building on wetlands, but then, you know, a lot of things get done even though they're not supposed to be done. And so it's not that we need new and better policies. We have them, but we need to implement them better than we've been able to implement them so far.
The worst of the destruction and the deaths recently, what was that due to?
Usually what happens with flood deaths, they are associated more with snake bites. People, you know, wading through water, there are poisonous snakes in the water. And very often people will get bitten by these snakes. So quite often the deaths due to floods are result of snake bite more than anything else. In Bangladesh, because we are downstream of the major rivers. So we know when the water is coming. And one of the biggest problems associated with flooding is less, as I said, deaths, but it is disease. So as the water now starts to recede, it's very dirty water. So, you know, it's full of sewage. And so people will get contaminated water ingest contaminated water and start getting diarrhea and diarrheal diseases. Although, having said that, again, Bangladesh is actually very well adapted to that. Bangladesh is now known not to, you know, be careful about getting fresh, clean drinking water, be prepared for diarrheal onsets. But the damage is still there, as I said. You know, the damage to property, damage to crops, damage, these are quite severe, and recovering and repairing will cost a lot of money.
And in terms of providing that, the extra support that's needed, obviously the city governments and national government is doing a lot, but I know you work a lot with the international community. What is your view in terms of how the international community should be responding?
Sure. So a little bit of background and then I'll answer your question. So the background is, as I said, floods are not unknown. Floods are natural. So it's the responsibility of the country's government and authorities to look after their own citizens, and Bangladesh tries to do that. Bangladesh, being a poor country, often doesn't have enough money to do it, and the global community very often comes to our assistance. So we get lots of charity coming in from developed countries and NGOs like Oxfam and CARE and others working, and they're all working here. Everybody's out in the field right now helping people. So that's sort of like a natural phenomena without climate change factoring in. However, now with climate change factoring in, and namely human-induced climate change, it means that the severity of this event is no longer a 100% natural event. There is an element of human-induced contribution, which is not zero anymore. We don't know how much it is. We don't know whether it's 10% or 20% or 1%, but it's not zero. And therefore, the intensity of the event, not the event itself, I mean, the event would have happened without climate change, but it would not have been so severe. It's the same argument for hurricanes Irma and Harvey. And so it's the contribution of climate change to making the event worse than it otherwise would have been that now introduces this element of man-made causation, which didn't exist before. And so if we accept that there is this man-made causation, then there is a responsibility for those who cause the problem of pollution of greenhouse gases to provide some kind of compensation or support. In the climate change negotiations, we call this loss and damage. The impacts are called loss and damage because of climate change. And what we, the poor countries, are asking for, and I that's what I work on and bring forward in these negotiations, is this demand for compensation. So we need to shift from what the paradigm we used to have before, which is charity. You know, we're poor people, we're suffering, help, and then people would help. We'd get charity. But now it's beyond charity. Now it's you cause the problem and you need to be helping us solve the problem and cope with the problem. There's an element of responsibility which doesn't come with charity. It's now a polluter pay principle. We're moving from a charity paradigm to a polluter pay paradigm. And the polluters are both rich countries who have caused the problem, but also companies like the fossil fuel companies who've made huge profits out of causing pollution. And so the demand now is for these countries and companies to be held responsible and at the very least to be providing some compensation from the profits that they've been made.
And a big step forward on that was taken at COP21. Could you describe what has been agreed so far and also how far there is still to go?
This issue of loss and damage, as I mentioned in the negotiations, is a highly politically contentious issue. In fact, one of the reasons why it isn't called liability and compensation, which it is, underlying the notion, as I said, is because the very words liability and compensation are taboo for the developed countries. They didn't allow us to use those words. So instead, they agreed to us using the words loss and damage. And that took a battle. So we finally managed to get in Article 8 of the Paris Agreement. It is an article addressing loss and damage. So that the principle of loss and damage has been accepted. The need to address it has been accepted. Now the question is, what do we do about it? And that's where we're going to push forward in the next Conference of Parties, which is in November in Germany, which is going to be presided over by the Prime Minister of Fiji, who has made this a big issue. So he has already stated that he wants the next Conference of Parties to focus on implementing this part of the Paris Agreement and actually addressing the issue of compensation and liability and basically untaboo this topic.
What do you think is the best possible outcome that could be achieved in Germany?
The outcome that needs to be achieved, and I think is even now, given the events that have happened, both the Asian, the South Asian floods, and even more importantly, the events in the United States, is that the recognition that this is no longer a topic that can be, you know, swept under the carpet. There is damage. Somebody has to pay for the damage. Interestingly, you know, in the United States of America, this is actually an accepted principle. So what is going to happen right now is that the state of Texas and the city of Houston are going to make damage assessments of how much monetary loss they had. And they're actually going to send a bill for loss and damage to Congress and ask Congress for the estimates right now are in the order of $100 billion for Texas and $100 billion for Florida for Irma. And then Congress will discuss this. And in the end, Congress will give them money. So this principle of providing compensation from the higher levels of government to the lower levels of government is quite well established within hierarchical governments, provinces and federal governments, for example. Now, what we want to do is to extend this principle to the global level. If the countries that are hit can't cope, can't manage, then there's a global responsibility to provide them with compensation after the event.
How would it be established whether the country can't manage?
Well, at the moment, the country just makes an appeal and people and others give them money. You know, the World Bank, the development banks, the bilateral aid agencies like DFID in the United Kingdom or USAID in the US. This is quite traditional. It happens all the time. But they do that under the paradigm of charity. These are aid agencies providing aid to help with reconstruction after an event. The UN Framework Convention is not an aid. It's not a development agency. It's a pollution treaty. The reason we have the Framework Convention is to deal with the pollution problem, the emissions of greenhouse gases, which are causing problems. And so under a pollution treaty, the principle then becomes a polluter pays principle, We need to adopt that. We need to find ways of assigning responsibility to polluters and for polluters to then contribute to funds to provide assistance to those that result. Again, this principle is not new. It's been applied, for example, in the case of oil spills from tankers in the high seas. There's a global protocol where all the oil tanker companies put money into a global fund that can be used for compensating any person or place or country that has harmed the coastline, particularly by an oil spill by a passing tanker. So you don't have to go and catch the tanker that spilled the oil that caused the damage on your beach. You can go to this fund and say, just show them the damage that has been caused, and then they'll get compensation for it. This is a mechanism that has been already set up some years ago. So these are not unprecedented issues that we can't solve. We need to apply these principles more urgently in the case of climate change now. Basically, what has happened in 2017 with the floods in South Asia and the hurricanes in the Atlantic and Caribbean is added urgency to have to deal with this problem. We used to think this is something that will come in the future. We need to start planning for it. But now, you know, as of 2017, the time for planning has passed. The time for doing it has come.
So this is all getting very depressing, to be honest. Like, give me a reason to be cheerful. What can we actually do about any of this stuff? Is there something cities can do to sort of prepare themselves for the worst?
There is. Thankfully, a report from Cities 100 came out this week, and they have 100 examples of how cities are adapting to climate change, how they're, you know, preparing for the worst, but also trying to reduce their own contribution to CO2 emissions.
Okay, so there's really two sides to this. There's kind of the resilience of the infrastructure, and there's actually reducing emissions, basically.
And there's so many different ways cities are doing it. And one of the most, I thought, hopeful things about the whole report was there were so many examples where the initiatives are really taking into account people on low incomes. How do you make new technology like electric cars, you know, available and accessible to everyone? How do you make sure everyone's involved? Shall I run you through a couple?
All right, yeah, give us a couple of examples. What inspired you here?
So at the kind of extreme end of American level, Silicon Valley level organization, you've got San Francisco in America, and they now require large commercial buildings to audit their energy savings and to report their energy usage every year. And that means 468 municipal buildings have cut their carbon emissions by more than 36%. And in the private sector, I think there's been a 10% reduction in electricity usage in upgraded buildings. And the reporting requirements have created jobs, and the whole thing is likely to expand. So it's one example of building a whole new sector around something that is, you know, good for the city.
I find that interesting, just this kind of phenomenon of what is measured moves. You come across that phrase? Well, like, if you're kind of paying attention to a particular number, you're much more likely to be able to improve it just because everyone's looking at it.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. You need to know.
You need to know the mess you're making to be able to clear it up, basically.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay, what else you got?
So the other end in America, New Orleans, which was hit obviously very badly by Hurricane Katrina, has since invested in its most vulnerable neighbourhoods. They have an emergency account program, which creates emergency funds for a disaster response if something like that hit again. And they match financial savings for low and moderate income earners. And it's also invested in green infrastructure. So something a lot of cities have done is invest in creating more parks and cities, which both act as, you know, things that can really just make people's lives nicer when the floods aren't around. But then when the floodwaters do come, it's space for that floodwater to go and be absorbed into the soil instead of running off the roads and concrete and the development, which causes a lot of the problems with flooding.
Yeah, no, again, this is quite a common problem, is very heavily developed cities, you often end up with there just not being much absorbent ground around.
That's so true.
By ensuring there's green space, you not only kind of have this, have it for leisure utility, it's also better for the environment because it will just absorb flood waters should they come.
Exactly. And then at the other end of the the climate scale when you've got extreme heat, which is equally as life-threatening as flood. Mexico City is harvesting its rainwater so it can reduce pressure on its groundwater and aquifer systems and make sure there's drinking water for everyone. And they've done this by creating nearly 500 harvesting devices and water purification devices. And the program is also being installed and maintained by women who've suffered domestic violence. So it's creating jobs for these women, creating ways out, which just seems like a very thoughtful and linked up thing to do.
Yeah, it's interesting how many of these approaches are kind of bringing in that sort of more social element, what is basically a sort of infrastructure program.
The truly hopeful thing is in being faced with a problem as vast as climate change, you are forced to think about how people are vulnerable in all kinds of ways. So if solutions can be made to work on multiple levels, that's just all to the good.
That's a cheery note to end on. I don't think we're going to find another cheery note in this particular subject. So we'll see you next time.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.